Take cover. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Bastille Day, Thursday, July 14th, 2016. A torrent of leaks indicates that Donald Trump is about to announce Neanderthal Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. Now, Donald Trump is highly unpredictable. This could be a total fake-out, and it could be Chris Christie or Newt Gingrich or General Mike Flynn or somebody we haven't even heard about under consideration. But the indications are that Trump has settled on Mike Pence, and the flashback here about the misdirect on vice presidential naming is to 2004. And still here at the Secret Studio, I have a yellowing copy of the New York Post from July of 2006 with the headline and a photograph, Kerry Picks Gebhardt as VP. That would have been the former House leader, Gebhardt, from the, I think he was from Iowa, if I remember correctly. And that turned out to be false. And we're told that the story was fed to the editors of the New York Post by the paper's owner, one Keith Rupert Murdoch, who ordered them to run the story and then had egg all over his face. So Trump could change his mind, right? But it appears that this episode of the Celebrity Apprentice Vice Presidential Division is coming to a close. And since the Trump family trotted out to Indianapolis to meet the Pence family yesterday, that speculation continues unabated. No women were considered, at least from the pool of candidates that were told. Jeff Sessions, the extreme right-wing senator of Alabama, was interviewed yesterday. And Carly Fiorina, who was obviously running for vice president from the start of her campaign in this cycle, is nowhere to be found. She, of course, did join the dump Trump forces a while back, and Trump is not a forgiving sort of person. And I am linking to an independent evaluation of Mike Pence's record as governor and as a five-term member of the House of Representatives. It's an independent site called ontheissues.org, and you can peruse this for yourself. For example, on civil rights, he voted no on prohibiting job discrimination based on sexual orientation. He, of course, last year created a firestorm when he signed into law a so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana, which made it legal for businesses in Indiana to discriminate against LGBTQ persons. And so he has been really on the leading edge of the far right. So far on that edge, he could fall off it at any moment. But this is appealing to Donald Trump. Here's an establishment Republican, a governor of a state in the middle of the country that is going to go for the Republican, almost predictably. So what is the reason that Mike Pence is on the ticket? Well, he is a slavish apologist for whomever it is he looks up to or is in the political pecking order above him. And I'll just take you back to, this was about 2005 or 2006. As a member of Congress, Mike Pence went to Baghdad and declared that the city was safe because he was able to walk into a market square and there were some 85 troops and snipers and security personnel who were securing the area and walking along with Mike Pence. I think John McCain was there, and the cameras were rolling as Mike Pence just declared that, hey, the surge has worked and Iraq is a safe place. And of course, it was only, what, 10 days ago that one of the most bloody assaults occurred near Baghdad and more than 300 people were killed. So this is a somewhat predictable choice from an unpredictable Donald Trump. And I'll also note that Mike Pence was on the leading edge of cutting off funding to Planned Parenthood. He was one of the very first governors to demonize that agency. And Donald Trump is not in lockstep with Pence on some of these issues. He has been more balanced about Planned Parenthood, saying they do provide some important services. And there are a few other differences between the candidates. But, of course, Trump will just bulldoze right past all that. I think also Pence, to his credit, did publicly criticize Trump over his announced plan to ban all Muslims from entering the United States. Now, a polling group called Morning Consult sent me an email this morning, and results from a survey they did over the weekend say that among likely voters, only 12% say that Mike Pence added to the ticket would make them more likely to support Trump. Among Republicans, the number is 22% who say they are more likely to vote for a Trump ticket with Pence on it. And maybe they just like the lineup of two guys with five-letter last names. It'll make a real easy bumper sticker, right? So, you know, this also dredges up memories of the last vice president drawn from the Hoosier state. That would be Dan Quayle. And also, just to be a little fair, Evan Bayh, who is a retread United States senator and the son of a famous political father, Birch Bayh, he has decided, after claiming that being in the Senate was a useless waste of his time, he has decided to try to reclaim that Senate seat this fall in Indiana. So things are happening in the land of the Hoosiers, and it's interesting to see how the Trump decision has been rolled out, very much like a, you know, a celebrity marketing campaign, not a typical political effort. Now, Chris Christie is the guy left at the altar, and he, of course, was hoping that people would overlook his bully behavior and his empty record as the governor of New Jersey. But I think we have to give credit to one Rachel Maddow, who went way overboard in the coverage of Chris Christie's so-called Bridgegate scandal. And I think that she created such a fuss and a firestorm that it was a huge liability for Chris Christie. And just yesterday, perhaps because he now knows that Christie is not going to be the Veep nominee, David Sampson, who was a very close associate of Christie, Christie made him chairman of the very powerful Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and Sampson helped with the cover-up of the Bridgegate scandal. Well, he has just taken a guilty plea to a felony in connection with the federal prosecution of that 2013 scandal. It also uncovered that using his clout running the Port Authority, that Sampson was able to intimidate United Airlines into maintaining a money-losing flight from Newark's Liberty International Airport to a little airport in Columbia, South Carolina, for the convenience of Mr. Sampson. And just 3 days after he resigned his position as chair of the Port Authority, the airline discontinued that flight. So where do we stand now? Well, the latest polls show that Hillary Clinton has taken a pretty big hit over the non-indictment over her emails. And despite the claim from many of her supporters that this amounts to an exoneration, we know that the FBI director laid out the facts showing that Hillary Clinton brazenly and repeatedly lied to the American people in public statements and in statements under oath before the Benghazi fishing expedition. And that could result in some further issues. We'll get to the status of the emails here in just a second. But what is clear is that we're now in a dead heat, where the national numbers show that both Clinton and Trump are drawing about 40% of likely voters. And in critical battleground states, the Quinnipiac poll showed that in Ohio and Pennsylvania, it's either neck and neck or Trump has a slight advantage. And while these numbers are going to shift, and we'll see things go up during the week of the Republican convention, and then we'll see things go up for Clinton during the week of the Democratic convention, the underlying numbers are pretty damaging. Only 28% of voters say they have a positive view of Hillary Clinton, compared with 33% last month. Yes, that's a decline of 5 points. And can she recover those 5 points between now and November? There are 117 days till the election. Now, 24% are in total denial. They said that Hillary did nothing wrong. And that shows that 76%, if you do the math, think that she probably did do something wrong. And on issues unrelated to the emails, like how the candidate would handle the economy and jobs, last month it was evenly split. And now it is a huge lead. It's 11 points for Donald Trump, 52-41. So it's not just on the issue of honesty and trustworthiness and credibility that Hillary Clinton is suffering. And despite that email investigation being declared closed by the FBI, Jason Leopold continues to investigate over at Vice News, and his attorney, Ryan James, filed another motion in U.S. District Court on Wednesday trying to clarify when the FBI is going to release certain emails that it said it couldn't release because they would harm the investigation. And now that the investigation is presumably completely closed, Vice News and Leopold are asking to see some of the email communications between the FBI and State Department related to the server and the emails. Also, the release of the emails that the FBI was able to dredge up, that were never turned over by Clinton and her team to the State Department, claiming that they were personal, when it appears they were not. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And I don't expect James Comey or the Attorney General Loretta Lynch to about face and say, oh, never mind what I said before, we're going to indict Hillary. But it is the damage politically that this continues to produce, and we must remind you that it was all self-inflicted. Meanwhile, the Clinton communications machine appears to be shifting into a mode that I would call crush all. And because of the tightness of the polls, the Clinton team is paying close attention to third-party candidates, like Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, who they hope will draw votes away from Donald Trump. And they appear very concerned about Jill Stein, the medical doctor who is the leading candidate for the Green Party nomination. And I am sharing via the show file to this podcast a link to a Facebook page that is run by an anonymous person who calls him or herself Democrats United for Victory in 2016. And this Facebook page has shifted from daily attacks on Bernie Sanders to now attacking Jill Stein. And the infographic that they posted today with a series of groupthink comments posted by people I don't know on Facebook, they use an infographic with a picture of Jill Stein, and it simply says, Jill Stein, anti-science. And this smear is based on rational remarks that she has made about vaccination and about genetically modified organisms. And in each case, she expresses concern about the role of corporate lobbyists and corporate interests in the establishment of policies requiring everyone to be vaccinated and policies related to denial of the impact of GMOs. And so I think that her position is quite rational. And just for the record, I am pro-vaccine, but I think that parents should ultimately have the option of opting out, particularly if their child has medical conditions that suggest that the vaccines might do more harm than good. And, you know, people can slam me if you think that that is anti-science. But it appears that the pro-vaccinators believe that if you don't agree with them 100%, that you are some kind of diminished life form. So let me just read a couple of these posts here. I put up one after reading the comments that said, this thread is a breathtaking example of pro-Clinton groupthink. Stein's rational comments on vaccines and GMOs are twisted into anti-science by this anonymous pro-Clinton spinmeister. But here are comments, and I won't bother with the names. I don't know who these people are. One person posted, kook. Any Sanders fanatic who votes for Jill Stein is either clueless or self-serving and classless. Now, that's quite a dismissal, quite a sweeping indictment. The next poster chimes in. In other words, she's a quack. Then somebody else says, I stand corrected. She is a quack. Then the next comment here, before dumping on the United States, Stein basically noted that American policy was best practice. And then next, she is another idiot and a perfect match for Bernie or bust idiots, bunch of ideologues. Then somebody posted a comment in favor of Jill Stein, and then somebody else gratuitously adds, anti-Semitic comments come from Jill Stein as well. That's because she's even-handed, related to Israel and Palestine. And so the list goes, these comments continue. And it is really frightening to me to see so many people who can just climb on board a groupthink bus and try to outdo one another with slams and smears and slights that are not based on rational thinking. And many people of my ilk think that the only idiots out there are people who support Donald Trump. But there are idiots who support Hillary Clinton, and many of them are quite proud of it. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has acknowledged that her recent remarks about Donald Trump were ill-advised. She called Trump a faker who really has an ego, says whatever comes into his head at the moment. She worried about his impact on the country. And she issued a statement saying, on reflection, my recent remarks in response to press inquiries were ill-advised and I regret making them. Judges should avoid commenting on a candidate for public office in the future. I will be more circumspect. Well, I think that this is the right position to take, and it wasn't politically advisable for her to say what she said. But I still defend her First Amendment rights. She's got them just like the rest of us should have. The CIA director is being asked about what would happen if Donald Trump becomes president because Trump has said he wants to resume torture, including waterboarding and much more. Trump has also said that he wants to target the families of alleged terrorists and kill their children. Well, John Brennan, and I'm going to acknowledge right at the start that he's a hypocrite here, but I agree with his current position. He says, if a president were to order the agency to carry out waterboarding or something else, it'll be up to the director of CIA and others within CIA to decide whether or not that direction and order is something that they can carry out in good conscience. As long as I'm director of CIA, irrespective of what the president says, I'm not going to be the director of CIA who gives that order. They'll have to find another director. But when George Tenet gave that order, and John Brennan was one of his number two officers at CIA, there is no indication that he refused to execute those orders. So I do agree with his current position. It's consistent with recently amended the law. Congress passed a bill taking Obama's anti-torture executive order and putting it into statute. And as of today, the official rules are that the CIA cannot use interrogation methods that aren't listed in the Army Field Manual. But Brennan makes an important point that anybody knows, and that is that most of the orders that Obama has given, not the one I just cited that has been embedded into law, but, for example, his orders about the drone strikes and what the standards are to target an individual, what the standards are to take risks of killing innocent civilians nearby, and those are all based on executive orders that can be changed by the incoming president, made tighter, looser, and even more secret than the way Obama has operated. Every day I like to take a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, people who subscribe, people like Joe Clarici, who just survived a motorcycle accident. We're glad you're still with us, Joe. Brian Massey, Andy Krieger, and Benny Alto, who's taken out subscriptions for each of his three pets. I am grateful to each and every one of you and to Benny's dogs, and I want to encourage some new people to sign up. We need some fresh blood here to keep the podcast going, And I'd like you to sign up for a subscription today. Go to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then select Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page where we dangle offers of free bonus books in front of you for a new annual subscription and a mailing address in the continental United States. While I was on vacation, the British government released the long-awaited report by Sir John Chilcot into Great Britain's role in the war in Iraq. And it confirmed what many of us knew, and that was we were lied to about WMD and the urgency of taking down the government of Saddam Hussein. But Stephen Zunis, professor of politics here at the University of San Francisco, writing this week at The Progressive, notes that even if Saddam did have active and usable weapons of mass destruction, it was still illegal for the U.S. and Britain and the so-called allies, the coalition of the billing, to engage in this violation of international law. And Professor Zunis points out that the U.N. Charter it declares unequivocally that the U.N. Security Council alone has the power to authorize the use of military force against any nation in noncompliance of its resolutions. And inconveniently, Zunis points out today there are three other countries that remain in violation of Security Council resolutions. Israel, which continues to reject calls to place its nuclear facilities under trusteeship of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and also India and Pakistan, who are under resolutions to eliminate their nuclear arsenals and long-range missiles. So I think the professor makes a very interesting point here. I'm sharing his commentary via a link in the show file at peterbcollins.com. A few months ago, I reported to you on the novel lawsuit filed by an active American member of the military, Captain Nathan Smith. He's an Army intelligence officer deployed to Kuwait currently, supporting the war in Syria. And he filed a lawsuit demanding clarification that President Obama has the authority to wage these wars. And in the polite language of the New York Times, while Mr. Obama has not received new and explicit authorization from lawmakers for the war against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, its brief said that the president has determined that he has the authority to take military action and that Congress has ratified that determination by appropriating billions of dollars in support of the military operation. Now, this is a duality that I have been pointing out for almost 2 years now, since Obama launched military operations in Syria in August of 2014. He had 90 days to get confirmation or a war powers resolution from the Congress. The Congress didn't take it up. The president made some not very convincing calls for Congress to pass some sort of war powers authorization, but also claimed that they already have the authorization under the blank check given to Bush after 9/11 and the 2002 authorization for the original invasion of Iraq. But we know that these do not apply to the Islamic State, which didn't exist at the time of those measures. And yet, the courts rejected, or at least they appear to be ready to reject this lawsuit based on the arguments of the Obama administration. And it even drew an interesting comment from Tim Kaine, a pretty conservative Democrat. He's a senator from Virginia, and he is one of the people on the short list as a potential running mate for Hillary Clinton. And he said, "A decision to fund defense operations is vastly different than a war authorization. Our troops risking their lives deserve to know whether Congress stands with them. But the chicken hawks in Congress are willing to snipe at President Obama, saying he should have put more troops in, he should have left more troops in Iraq, and he should carpet bomb and all this falderal. But they don't have the courage to stand up and put their signature and their fingerprints on an actual authorization to conduct these military operations." Now that I've been slamming the Congress, I have something good to say about 25 members of the House of Representatives. 13 Republicans and 12 Democrats have just announced the House Fourth Amendment Caucus, and I am delighted to see this. It's only about 10 years too late to try to protect our Fourth Amendment constitutional rights against illegal search and seizure without probable cause and a court order, a warrant. But I'm pleased to see that Justin Amash, who is a conservative Tea Party member from Michigan, and Zoe Lofgren, a liberal Democrat from Silicon Valley here in California, and I don't have the list of the other members, I'm going to try to find it, but I encourage you to contact your member of Congress and tell him or her that they should sign up for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus. It's about time that we protect our constitutional rights. Now to Fresno, California, where the latest police shooting, captured on video, brings new information today. The original video, shot on the 25th of June, showed the final shots that killed 19-year-old Dylan Noble. He's a white guy who's driving a pickup truck. The officers, two of them, got a radio call suggesting that he might have a gun in that truck. They pull him over in a gas station. And to be fair, Dylan Noble did not follow all of the orders that the cops gave him. At one point, they're telling him to put both hands out the window of his truck. And then, despite the fact that two guns are aimed at him by these cops, Dylan Noble defies their orders, gets out of the truck, starts to walk away a little bit. Then he turns around, starting to walk back, and to be fair to the cops, at one point, his right hand was behind his back. But earlier in the video, I caught a glimpse of his back, and there wasn't anything protruding like a gun or anything that could be used against the cops. So they fired a couple of shots, put him on the ground, and then what's really outrageous is they fired another shot, and then they fired a fourth shot, and at that point it appears that Dylan Noble expired. His father, after seeing the videotape last week, said they just wanted to shoot him. They're just trigger-happy. And a lawsuit filed by the family describes an inexcusable use of excessive force. And what it shows, the new body camera footage released today, shows that the cops shot to kill every time. Even after he was laying on the ground, they say that he reached into his waistband. I didn't see that in the video. So they shot him again, and then they shot him again. And the police chief in Fresno, Jerry Dyer, said that it appears that Noble did have something in his hand. But then he got honest for a minute. He said, were the last two rounds fired by the officers necessary? Based on a reasonable fear, did the officers have to use deadly force? I do not have the answer to that today. And he added that video was extremely disturbing to watch. And while we're talking about Fresno and the police department, I just want to update you that I have no new information on the January death of John Lang. He was an activist in Fresno. He posted these kind of fateful warnings on Facebook that he thought the cops were out to get him. He was taken into custody and he died in police custody. And I have never seen an adequate report investigating what happened to John Lang. Meanwhile, I want to point out that I have just seen today an interesting new video which includes many celebrities who speak brief phrases. The subject of the video is 23 ways you could be killed if you are black in America. Let's listen to a little.
Failing to signal a lane change.
Riding in your girlfriend's car with a child in the back.
Running to the bathroom in your own apartment.
Selling cigarettes outside of a corner store.
Riding a commuter train.
So each celebrity delivers a line, and then you see the picture of Freddie Gray or Sandra Bland or Eric Garner. It's a very powerful piece, and Alicia Keys and a foundation that she runs have assembled this. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, and I encourage you to share it widely. Cornel West has really proven his independence this year. As a free-thinking public intellectual who happens to be African-American. And I applaud his service on the Democratic National Committee's Platform Committee on behalf of Bernie Sanders. And today, he published a commentary at The Guardian where he deeply criticizes President Obama. And the only other black public figure who has even come close recently is Michael Eric Dyson. And Cornel West writes, I have deep empathy for brothers and sisters who are shot in the police force. I also have profound empathy for people of color who are shot by the police. I believe deliberate killing is a crime against humanity. But Obama didn't go to Baton Rouge, Minneapolis. He flew over their heads to go to Dallas. His fundamental concern was to speak to the police. That was his priority. But when he references the Black Lives Matter movement, it's to speak to the police. The people who are struggling have a different perspective. The very notion that Dallas is the paragon of policing is something that needs to be interrogated. The Dallas mayor said, "We have done nothing wrong, but look at your history. Ask people in southern Dallas about the police. Ask Clinton Allen, an unarmed black man fatally shot by the Dallas police in 2013. And he says, unfortunately, Obama thrives on being in the middle. He has no backbone to fight for justice. He likes to be above the fray. But for those of us who are in the fray, there is a different sensibility. You have to choose which side you're on, and he doesn't want to do that. Fundamentally, he's not a love warrior. He's a polished professional. Martin Luther King Jr., Adam Clayton Powell Jr., and Ella Baker, they were warriors. Obama's attitude is that of a neoliberal, and they rarely have solidarity with poor and working people. Whatever solidarity he does offer is just lip service to suffering, but he never makes it a priority to end that suffering." And then the surprise here is that Cornel West is not going to vote for the Democratic nominee. He said, "This November we need change. Yet we are tied in a choice between Trump, who would be a neo-fascist catastrophe, and Clinton, a neoliberal disaster. That's why I'm supporting Jill Stein. I'm with her, the only progressive woman in the race, because we've got to get beyond this lockjaw situation." Well said, Cornel West. And that's where things stand here on July 14th, 2016. Thanks for listening to my News and Comment podcast. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails.